Now might be a really good time for you to get angry.
That's my secret, Captain. I'm always angry.
From New York City, the makers of Clipper Craft Clothes for Men and more than 1,200 leading retail stores from coast to coast presents Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's immortal character, the world's most famous detective, Sherlock Holmes.
Mr. McGee!
Mr. McGee, don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
Yes, we hope you like us when we're angry. I'm Dean Karyanis.
And I'm Owen Mugen. Welcome back to the Angry History Show.
This is a great day to step through the Guardia forever, but we don't know what we're going to find on the other side. What do we have on tap today, Owen?
Well, today, Dean, it's a bit of a mystery.
Oh, I get it.
Ooh, the man behind the greatest literary detective of all times, Sherlock Holmes. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's character kicked off over a century of detective novels, radio shows, movies, TV shows, and even cartoons.
Where are you? We got some work to do now.
Holmes first appeared in a novel, 1887's A Study in Scarlet, and jumped to film almost from the minute there was film. The earliest known film is 1900. So William McKinley could have gone and had a look at it, for example.
Absolutely.
Think how long ago it was.
It would have been ghost voice McKinley.
This is a wonderful movie. This is a truly fascinating tale of our British detective.
Sorry, I didn't know what the hell that was supposed to be.
That is what it sounds like in our head, though, right? We talked about those clips. In the Universal Sherlock Holmes, Ronald B. Mm-hmm. DeWall catalogs over 25,000 productions and products related to the great detective.
Insane.
And in the 20 years since that publication, there have been many more, like Elementary and the versions featuring Robert Downey Jr. and Benedict Cumberbatch.
Yep, and people are still so anxious to get their hands on Holmes that actually the legal battle over who owns the character reached all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. In November 2014, the High Court let stand a ruling by the Seventh Circuit Court that, contrary to a case brought by the Conan Doyle estate, only the 10 later Holmes stories are protected by copyright. The rest are all in the public domain, you know, which I think accounts for the character's sort of unceasing popularity throughout the decades. Practically anyone could do a Holmes project.
And there was an Alan Sherman bit that you were telling me about.
Sophia Loren.
Oh boy.
Chief Justice Warren.
Oh boy.
Merrill Lynch, Pierce Fanner, Smith, and the whole B'nai B'rith.
Yeah, this sort of speaks to the notion that even in the 60s, up until the 60s, you know, Conan Doyle was a very well-known quantity. Courtesy of the man in the deerstalker hat. Alan Sherman, the great singer, Hello Mudda, Hello Father, you know, you guys at least know that. He had an amazing album out in 1962 called My Son the Folk Singer, which was mostly a bunch of parody songs. And one of them, The Ballad of Old Boy, was one of these shout-out songs, you know, giving you a sense of what folks in the early 60s were talking about. It's kind of like We Didn't Start the Fire, you know, how Billy Joel runs down the list of things through the years. But this is sort of, you know, a bit of what folks in Alan Sherman's 1962 were talking about. And here's a line that cracked the crowd up and pricked up my young ears. Give a listen.
Movies with Barton McClane.
Boy.
Arthur and other kinds of pain.
Boy.
Sir Arthur Conan and Doyle.
Both great.
It's funny, this whole album, by the way, which you should get, is classic. The cues from the crowd are so great. It's one of those, it's almost like watching Looney Tunes listening to this album as a kid. Like, I always knew that there was something going on which was outside of my child level. I just didn't necessarily always understand what it was. But yeah, the crowd response to this is great. But anyway, yeah, a little reach out to the Holmes of the 60s. He was even impactful then.
Yeah, it's something that he only now has come to be a legal battle, obviously long after the author is dead. And it's almost as if he's at last broken free from his real-life master and become his own man. But anyone who's ever enjoyed a whodunit owes a debt of gratitude not to the pipe-smoking, violin-playing detective, but to Sir Arthur. His template for a detective applying science and reason to solving cases inspired characters like Columbo and the corpulent gourmand Nero Wolfe, written by Rex Stout.
I always liked Nero Wolfe. Those shows were great. What was that? What's that disgusting, stinky flower that he always had in the front? His guy Archie would always find him in there.
Did he have a corpse flower? Yeah, those are pretty rare. They flower very rarely, and they smell like you would think something called a corpse flower smell.
I'm sure we're going to get killed for getting it wrong, but that was one of his...
orchids on the top floor.
That's what it was. Yeah. But I always loved Nero Wolfe. And Rex Stout, it's fun, a bit of historical linkage here, actually, about Rex Stout. He served Theodore Roosevelt as a yeoman aboard the presidential yacht. which is pretty cool. I'm sure we'll find out something that he did with or against Wilson in a few minutes. But anyway.
Yeah, one thing I did not think of this as we were talking about this show and about this idea of applying logic and reason to solving crimes. Recently, we lost Leonard Nimoy, of course, and we did a little obit show on that. But I thought about, as far as characters go, how Spock, you know, was in line with this. And I just remembered now when he actually mentions him and says, an ancestor of mine. I guess that's, what is that? Generations? Or no, Undiscovered Country. I'm sorry. When he says an ancestor of mine and he's quoting Sherlock Holmes.
An ancestor of mine maintained that if you eliminate the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth.
Oh, wow. I don't remember that reference at all. That's a great one. I blocked that out.
There's the cloaked bird of prey, and that's Sherlock Holmes,
right.
And that's
Occam's razor. Yeah.
When he says one of my ancestors, and he really was. There's so many tendrils of this character, and he now kind of belongs to all of us.
He does. He brought forward this notion of really using science in detective work, and we'll talk in a little bit about how that really struck a chord with folks, especially when he moved into radio. But here's a clip of Sir Arthur from a 1927 Fox newsreel interview. He was almost 70 at the time, and he's explaining what made him angry about the detective stories of the Gilded Age. Give a listen.
It all annoyed me how in the old-fashioned detective story, the detective always seemed to get at his results either by some sort of lucky chance or a fluke, or else it was quite unexplained how he got there. He got there, but he never gave an explanation how. Well, it didn't seem to me quite playing the game. It seemed to me that he's bound to give his reasons why he came to his conclusions. I began to think of turning scientific methods, as it were, onto the work of detection.
We know much about Holmes and that work of detection that Doyle was just talking about, but less about the man behind him, knighted by King Edward VII in 1902 as Sir Arthur Ignatius Conan Doyle. And that has to make you a little bit angry for him as an artist.
Yeah.
He felt he had more serious things to write, historical fiction, novels of this kind, early things, you know, he was interested in science fiction before it really even was a genre. For instance, he wrote Captain of the Pole Star, inspired by his time as a young doctor aboard a whaling boat. It did rankle the author, who felt Holmes was a commercial character that overshadowed his more serious work. And that's something that he actually said. Commercial. Sounds sort of like a modern concern, but...
I'm successful. Conan Doyle grew so frustrated with Holmes that he eventually threw him to his death off Reichenbach Falls in Switzerland. Not to be confused with the Reichenbach Hall in Midtown Manhattan, where you may actually fall down, but not because Professor Moriarty is conspiring against you. Here's another clip from that Fox newsreel where he addresses the subject of fans being unable to separate Holmes from the real-life author behind him. You can hear a little bit of contempt in his voice, too, actually.
Well, the curious thing is how many people there are in the world who are perfectly convinced that he is a living human being. I get letters addressed to him. I get letters asking for his autograph. Get letters addressed to his rather stupid friend, Watson.
All right, stop for a second. Did you catch that? His rather stupid friend, Watson. It's funny, I never actually thought of Watson as stupid. In fact, he's, you know, in these books, he's the proxy for all of us, marveling over the acute deductive reasoning of Holmes. Maybe he doesn't like his readers. That link between reader and Watson may tell us a little bit about how Doyle feels about these very dedicated fans, you know, writing letters of admiration to fictional characters, much like ones that Dr. McCoy never returned to me.
Yeah. Oh, that, I bet that's not true. He would write back. Come on.
He would. He did.
Well, we could pick up that again, but that really was something that struck both of us. I remember you said it stopped you on your walk. The idea that you would call him stupid, and you feel defensive for him, which is a crazy position to be in because it's his character. He can call him whatever he wants.
Right.
You know Watson through all these incarnations and things, and you know he's not stupid. And he, as you said, speaks for us. He's our place. He's sitting there marveling at this great mind, this sort of tortured soul who notices everything and is trying to put it all together. They illustrate that very well in the Robert Downey Jr. version. The noise, all the hypervigilance, the hearing everything and seeing everything around you and picking it up. That to hear him called stupid by anybody, even the author, it really catches you up short.
It does. It would be like Tolkien referring to, you know, Bilbo or Frodo as, you know, a jackass or a clown or something. It's just like, you know, whoa, didn't you birth these guys? You know?
Yeah, but, it's strange.
All right, let's pick this back up.
I've even had ladies writing to say that they'd be very glad to act as his housekeeper. One of them, when she heard that he had turned to the occupation of keeping bees, wrote saying that she was an expert at segregating the queen, whatever that may mean, and that she was evidently predestined to be the housekeeper of Sherlock Holmes.
Despite his frustration, Sir Arthur did have fun with the fans. He was a pretty fun-loving guy overall. There was one little anecdote about him. When he got his medical degree, he drew a little picture of him taking the scroll, and he wrote under it, "License to Kill." So,
that's pretty funny.
Sometimes people would write those fan letters to him, and he would send back the autograph they asked for and just sign Dr. John Watson.
Right.
He just called him stupid. So I guess he didn't think he was, if he was going to impersonate him, I guess he didn't think he was that stupid. But this relationship that he had with the character is familiar to us in an age when we see actors typecast as Gilligan,
right,
or we see a guy who's Arnold Horshack and he can't get another job after that. But this celebrity attention must have been all very new in this early age of mass media. When he killed off Holmes, for instance, and his syndicated stories in the Strand magazine, an incredible 20,000 readers canceled their subscription in protest.
That's so wild. I always forget, like, so many of these literary classics, these detective stories, started off in magazines. Like, you know, Hammett had a lot of the Continental Op and Sam Spade in Black Mask magazine, you know, in the 20s. It's really funny, you know, we have all these wonderful, you know, weighty tomes, you know, leather bound. And it's like, yeah, these were put in rags, you know, and this was like real fun, popular reading. Anyway.
Yeah, read it and wrap fish with it. You know, once you read it, you'd wrap fish, you know, or you'd use it for, well, other things. They didn't have, let's just say they didn't have toilet paper yet in the early days. So,
you know,
this is something you would just read and, yeah, that was it. It would be gone into the ether. So the idea that it became serious literature over time is really impressive.
It is. I wish I could do that with most websites. I guess I'd just have to print them out first. But
to remind me to stay away from your computer screen.
Yeah, good idea. Arthur Ignatius Conan Doyle was born to an Irish Catholic family in Edinburgh, Scotland, way back in 1859 when James Buchanan was the one cruising around on the presidential yacht. Doyle's dad, Charles Altamont Doyle, unfortunately suffered from alcoholism, but his mother, born Mary Foley, was an educated and spirited woman, by all accounts, as well as a master storyteller, and she instilled her son with a desire for adventure, one that would drive him to travel, enlist in two wars, and even run for office a couple of times.
Yeah, he tried to enlist, tried to run for office. Neither of those things worked out exactly how he wanted, but he always would get a good story out of it, and usually it had nothing to do with Sherlock Holmes. But again and again, whether he lost the election or whether they turned him away from enlisting in the army, he'd find himself pulled back to the detective. And even after throwing Holmes off the falls, as we discussed, he begrudgingly returned again and brought him back, although as a prequel. He refused to resurrect him outright, as they do sometimes characters. He just brought him back as a prequel, wrote an earlier story about him.
Right, which is good. He knew enough to not undo the thing that he did, which is something that we see so much in movies and things now. It's just like, you know, or even like, you know, cruddy sequels to, well, maybe I didn't read it, but like they had some Godfather sequel that was actually fairly well received. But it's like, all right, you can just leave it alone. You don't have to, you know, don't resurrect the dude. You know, prequel if you need to. I like that.
You realize it now because it's public domain that theoretically they could bring Holmes back and inject him with triple blood.
Oh, we almost got through this without talking about bad Star Trek. But so Conan Doyle wrote that his mother had a gift of, quote, sinking her voice to a horror-stricken whisper. I have a lot of aunts who used to do that. So while they didn't have much money, the young Conan Doyle didn't lack for adventure and escapes. And he later wrote that his mother's stories stuck in his head so much that they obscured the real facts of his life. The two remained close and exchanged letters for the rest of Mrs. Doyle's life.
Arthur described her influence in his autobiography. He wrote, quote, "Perhaps it was good for me that the times were hard, for I was wild, full-blooded, and a trifle reckless. But the situation called for energy and application, so that one was bound to try to meet it. My mother had been so splendid that I could not fail her."
And he did not fail her. Conan Doyle, by the way, he added his middle name to his surname later in life. Maybe, I don't know, to soften the anti-Irish bigotry he faced in the UK. We're recording this shortly after St. Paddy's Day of 2015, so the stories of the discrimination that the Irish have endured are fresh in our minds, as are plastic green hats. Dean?
I would never wear one of those.
No. Thank goodness for something called not photo evidence. These were stories all too familiar to the young boy destined for literary greatness.
I looked like the world's only Greek leprechaun.
He did. A giant one. It was like some sort of terrifying science and you know, religion experiment gone wrong.
Well, luckily they like me at my local bar that I go to. But anyway.
Exactly.
Conan Doyle, unfortunately, lived in a society where such jokes were not possible and were not accepted.
Anyway.
These things really would cut you if you were a young Irish person living in England, living under the British crown. Mm-hmm. And he was poor. He was Catholic. He has that alcoholic father. But he did catch an early break that changed his life. He had well-off relatives, and they paid his way through a boarding school in London. So at age 9, he left his parents behind as a young man of great expectations, as they say.
Yes.
And it was at school where, despite the bigotry and cruel corporal punishment that you've probably read about in a lot of places, mm-hmm. Arthur discovered that he, too, could spin masterful yarns. And they tell stories about other students gathering around to hear his tales.
Conan Doyle kept up with a lifelong letter correspondence with his mom, as we said. But his dad fell into a sort of downward spiral that landed him in the asylum. And perhaps this influenced Conan Doyle to enroll at the University of Edinburgh and train as a medical doctor. It was at university that the young man met Dr. Joseph Bell, who would act as the inspiration for Holmes.
I used, as a student, to have an old professor, his name was Bell, who was extraordinarily quick at deductive work. He would look at the patient, he would hardly allow the patient to open his mouth, but he would make his diagnosis of the disease, and also very often of the patient's nationality and occupation and other points, entirely by his power of observation. So naturally, I thought to myself, well, if a scientific man like Bell was to come into the detective business, he wouldn't do these things by chance. He'd get the thing by building it up scientifically. So, having once conceived that line of thought, you can well imagine that I had, as it were, a new idea of the detective, and one which it interested me to work out.
And the story's not only interested the author, but in time, hundreds of millions of readers around the world, across generations. Here, Arthur Conan Doyle describes how he conceived the early story ideas and how serialized Holmes took off.
I thought of 100 little dodges, as you may say, 100 little touches by which he could build up his conclusions, and then I began to write stories on those lines. At first, I think they attracted very little attention, but after time, when I began the short adventures, one after the other, coming out month after month in the Strand magazine, people began to recognize that it was different to the old detective, that there was something there which was new. They began to buy the magazine, and it prospered. So I may say, did I. We both came along together. And from that time, Sherlock Holmes fairly took root. I've written a good deal more about him than I ever intended to do, but my hand has been rather forced by kind friends who continually wanted to know more. And so it is that this monstrous growth has come out of what was really a comparatively small seed.
The seed may have seemed small, but looking back at Conan Doyle's life, we see how he cultivated the experiences and information he'd need to write convincingly. He jumped at those jobs aboard ships. He loved the one in the Arctic. He wrote that book about it. He was not so pleased traveling to Africa, but he did travel. He left his comfort zone, as I guess we'd say today. And he found time to fall in love with Louisa Hawkins. They married. They had children. Unfortunately, she later contracted tuberculosis, but even then, he dutifully cared for her.
Yeah, and sadly, he lost her. Louisa Doyle died in her husband's arms on July 4, 1906. And Conan Doyle suffered, particularly since he had been a doctor and had been unable to save her.
Yeah, and I picture the scene in Quincy, M.E. When they do a flashback of him, why he kind of never wanted to get married, which is a big deal in shows back then, right? You felt you had to explain it. He'd been a doctor, he'd been seeing patients and all, and he'd missed these signs of cancer in his wife. And that was one thing that they used to bring the character of Quincy into forensic medicine, because he had more time to spend with her as she passed away. Really moving, Jack Klugman at his best. That's a great episode. And so I kind of, through that, felt for him. And he was also a scientist and a doctor, so in a way, also definitely a descendant of this character, Sherlock Holmes.
I have to just make a little side comment here.
That was so sincere, and you are...
No. Allow me to speak. Don't wait for the translation. No, only you, and I say this, this is what makes me want to sit you down and cut the top of your head off and eat your brain with a spoon. But now you turn to Quincy reference. Of all things, You turned a Quincy reference into something actually heartfelt and something that is related to the story. And I freaking love that. So that's all. That's all I got to say.
I didn't do any of that. Jack Klugman did.
I know. And he did it for all of us. God bless.
Quince, do me a favor, will you?
Anything, honey. Anything.
You're a good man, Quince. We had a lot of good times. And let me tell you, if you dare marry again, put some other poor girl through all that, I swear I'll come back to haunt you.
I won't, I promise.
Today, divorce is usually the reason people have second families. In those days, again, 1906 when Louisa dies, disease and violence is what left surviving spouses to seek out a new start with somebody else. So it was with Conan Doyle. He embarked on a new adventure with a woman he'd remained chaste with, they make a point to say in all the bios, throughout his wife's long illness, Jean Leckie. It's L-E-C-K-I-E. So I think that's Leckie. Right.
Well, married again and needing some cash, Conan Doyle turned once more to Sherlock Holmes, like a son in a way. You know, rather than the father of the character needing to ask for a little scratch. It wasn't a book this time or a story, but a play. An American actor, William Gillette, read the script and asked if he could tweak Holmes. Conan Doyle replied, quote, "You can marry him, murder him, or do anything you like to him," end quote.
poor Holmes. Is it just being handed over to him? This love-hate relationship, I know. Maybe hate's too strong, but it seems like at times he really wanted to throttle him. He did throw him off right in Rock Falls, so hey. But people have been doing all of those things to Sherlock Holmes, marrying him, murdering him, doing whatever they like to him, especially more than ever now that he's in the public domain. That name just jumps out to you. I mean, we have sayings, know what, Sherlock.
Yeah, right.
That's a name that you think of when you think of detective.
Absolutely.
You think of being smart. I don't know that it'll ever go away because it's something so essential. And so when he embarks on this new journey with this new woman, he's forced to bring along Sherlock Holmes. He's kind of the third wheel, just like he is with Watson in some of those movies.
Yeah.
Watson wants to get married. He's dragging him around. Right. Don't get married. Come on. Here I am. You need me. It's very Stephen King, the way he writes sometimes about some of his characters taking on a life of their own and sort of stalking him.
No, it's great. And if you guys have not read the stories, do read them. These things are actually, they're extremely accessible. There's not a lot of old archaic language. They're remarkably accessible. And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that they were, serialized in a magazine you'd later use for toilet paper.
And Gillette, by the way, did take him up on his offer there, made so many changes that the original script was almost unrecognizable. But it was Gillette that gave us one thing, by the way. He gave the detective his catchphrase, "Elementary, my dear Watson."
Nice.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Of all these iterations you've talked about, one of the earliest, of course, was radio. Dean and I both enjoy old-time radio dramas a lot, many of which are available free to download. Shows like Gunsmoke, The Six Shooter with Jimmy Stewart, Bold Venture with Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall, Frontier Gentleman, which is great. Frontier Gentleman was a Brit in the frontier west of America, writing and reporting back to London, but he had all these adventures, which were a lot of fun. And he was a nice bit of contrast, having this gentlemanly Brit among the roughnecks of the Wild West.
Herewith, an Englishman's account of life and death in the West. As a reporter for the London Times, he writes his colorful and unusual accounts. But as a man with a gun, he lives and becomes a part of the violent years in the new territory. Now starring John Daner, this is the story of J.B. Kendall, Frontier Gentleman.
There's a town in Montana Territory where it's against the law to carry a gun. The sheriff lives by this order, but because of it, other men can die.
And we also talked about Paladin. That's the same actor, same voice actor there as Frontier Gentleman, I believe.
Right.
Again, this is something that sort of gave rise to a whole genre of not the smart detective necessarily, although Frontier Gentleman was that kind of a guy, but the man who made his living with a gun, protected the weak, the Superman type, truth, justice in the American way. And so these are really great to listen to, and you will love them if you are looking for more content like we offer here. If you're listening and these are historian themselves because they still have the commercials in there, and they're really fun.
It's great. No, that's so much history. And you talk about, Dean and I often wonder how many of our listeners, are listening to us in traffic on the way home, and you will never have a shortage of listening content if you want to just go down the old-time radio route. And there are things out there at the archives. You can listen to full news broadcasts from 80 years ago. Some of the stuff we had from that Battle LA show, you know, that's stuff that people listen to. You know, that was news stuff, and it's fascinating to listen to, you know, for me anyway, 30 minutes at a time.
And speaking of traffic, all right already, I could hear the guys from Angry Chimp show that already told us before, yes, they're leaning forward there. Don't run up your car. Okay, yes, we hear you. You're listening to us in traffic down under in Sydney.
So, absolutely.
Speaking of Sydney, of course, speaking of Australia, speaking of Botany Bay, brings us back to space. X minus one. We have to have a word for that.
Wait,
that,
say that again. Say that properly.
Say the title correctly. You mean X minus one.
Music to my ears. You know what's funny? You think about all these Sherlocks, and the most recent one is with Benedict Cumberbatch and Martin Freeman on the old BBC. The great thing about this one, it's a modern take on it, but because it's a modern take, what it allows to have happen is it allows Dr. John Watson to once again be a veteran of a war in Afghanistan, which was the case with the original Watson in the stories.
And that was also the case with the, may we mention, the Robert Downey Jr. version. That's sort of a mirror of it. You know, the British, of course, end up somehow going back there time and time again, as we've seen in history, back to Afghanistan, back to those mountains. And it isn't amazing to think about these stories. How can they still remain relevant? But because he was so well-traveled and so well-read, he was able to pretty much cover everything in the human experience. And again, these radio shows all in the public domain, as was that Fox newsreel. So we can play them for you without infringing on anybody's copyright and ending up before the Supreme Court.
As we have nightmares about. No.
Yeah. This is just the opening of the show, a dramatization of A Case of Identity. And we chose an original story that Sir Arthur wrote in 1891. Give a listen.
This week's adventure, A Case of Identity. What about tonight's story, Doctor?
Tonight I have prepared a little challenge for you and our radio friends. Yes, the story I'm going to tell is one of Holmes' more mental adventures. It has its bizarre moments, of course, but still, all in all, its solution is fairly obvious. As you know, Holmes was the world's greatest master of the science of deduction. As a matter of fact, he unraveled this particular problem without moving from his armchair. I wonder how many of our listeners have learned enough of Holmes' methods to do the same.
Well, I think I can make a fair stab at it, Doctor, if the clues aren't too involved, that is.
Oh, no, no. All the clues are right out in plain sight, Mr. Harris. All you have to do is listen for them and make your own deduction.
That's Cy Harris there as the announcer. And Dr. Watson, of course, you hear him talking to him and sort of, you know, staying in character. And it's a way to kind of bring you into the story. Again, he's our proxy. And it was a fascinating way to go, you know, to sort of invite people to listen a little extra closer, not just be spectators, right. You know, to really study the story that was going on.
Yeah.
Classic storytelling, right? Always leave them wanting a little bit, keep them hooked on and listening. We will link to the whole original show at angryhistory.com if you want to hear the rest and the young lady who comes and find out exactly what her problem is. But
yeah, she has, how much time you got? She has a lot. That woman has more issues than the National Geographic. I was sitting there listening to it the other night. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, it's great. They even throw in a couple of red herrings. She's wearing two different shoes, it turns out. And is that really just because she was rushing, or is that a clue? They wrote it really well. It's tight writing. The reading is a little bit stilted at times, but that's also endearing because these are pretty early days in radio. Not the very first, but pretty close to the first.
No.
They would remember the first. But it shows how those stories by Sir Arthur really tapped into something of this notion. And, you know, people wanted to try to outthink the great detective.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's so much fun. And I think this is the thing about mysteries, too. People really love them, you know, and I hear this, you know, time and again, how parents, mine included, my mom did this, you know, they would try to dangle a good mystery in front of a kid to get them to read, you know, try to turn them on to the notion of reading. In my case, my mom challenged me to read the first few books of the Great Brain series, which was like a detective, kind of like Encyclopedia Brown for kids back in the day. And it worked. I was hooked. We talked a little bit about Conan Doyle's keen sense of service to the Crown. He tried to enlist in the Boer War in 1900. When rejected due to being, you know, 40 and out of shape, this is, I'm not taking that personally. I'm 45. He volunteered as a medical doctor. The experience produced a magnificent book, The Great Boer War. 15 years later, he saw a new war on the horizon, this one with Germany.
This part of Conan Doyle's life shows how he really could think and deduce problems just like Holmes. That's what struck me about this reading. It's guys, one of these sort of Cassandra people in history where they see the future and nobody wants to listen to them. He warned not only about the coming conflict in general, which I suppose some people might have been able to see. They knew how the Kaiser was thinking. They knew they could see that that was a big rival, this huge army building, but also about how Germany could be expected to prosecute the war and attack with submarines and airplanes. I mean, this is early on to think that, you know, that we all know these stories if we read history of, oh, well, you're never going to be able to use planes to attack. You're never going to be able to land planes on an aircraft carrier. Well, what are you even thinking about? But these things always are rejected, and some people have this foresight. He feared a blockade, and in fact, a blockade came. He also suggested that the only solution would be a channel tunnel, a tunnel under the English Channel. Now, that's the most amazing one to me. I've gone through the channel, and I guess you could imagine it maybe, but this is 80 years before the channel ultimately opened in 1994 that he had this idea.
No, it's great. It's great. It shows a fertile mind. I wondered about that, too. You know, you're saying, you know, how he was able to deduce and think like Holmes. And I wonder about that. I wonder, you know, what the powers of the creator have to be. I mean, was Agatha Christie, was her mind so fertile that she was able to write all of her, was it Miss Marple?
Yeah.
And I think about it, you know, in the times that, you know, you and I both also write fiction. And, you know, I'm thinking of one character in particular who you know well. And at one point, if a person's being pursued by a detective, like the funny approach is, it's like, okay, how am I going to do this? I'm thinking to myself, I've never written a detective, you know, a mystery, anything before. But you put yourself in the mindset of, well, here's what actually happened. And then you can sort of build backwards and form a basis for investigation. I'm not sure how Conan Doyle did it, but it's fascinating. Fascinating stuff. Yeah. Not easy writing mysteries that are good.
Well, he mentioned in that one little clip there that we played, he says it right away when he started thinking about it, he thought of 100 little catches, he said.
That's right.
So by observing things and by observing this Dr. Bell that he was apprenticing on there in medical school, I think those things just stuck in his mind and he was able to really apply them. But amazingly prolific. Amazing that when he needed to kind of go to the ATM, he was able to go and do it.
That
it was applicable to other things. The hosts that I work for say, you ever try to talk to just a writer? Like sometimes they're the most boring person in the world, as exciting as the things are that they write. But he did more with his life, so much more, and saw so much more coming than just a guy who was kind of hiding quietly behind Sherlock Holmes.
He wanted
to be more than that. He wanted to be serious. He wanted to serve his country. He wanted to help people as a doctor. He did so much more than that.
Yeah. Talk about, you know, these writings and some of these things that may seem like of a futurist bent, you know, looking at the channel, you know, so long before it was even conceived or built. At the time, a lot of people dismissed his writings as something out of Jules Verne. But one man at the War Office appreciated the suggestions for things like inflatable lifeboats and body armor, actual terms he used. The man was, to drop another name, Winston Spencer Churchill, cha-ching, who wrote to thank the author for his ideas.
Yep, and of course, Conan Doyle, as you might expect, he enlisted Sherlock Holmes in the war effort with his novel, His Last Bow, in which the great detective exposes a German spy ring. Whenever he needed him, I just love this notion.
I know, it's great.
His head was on straight enough that he wasn't sitting there talking with the dummy
right.
in the Twilight Zone, but, you know, where he goes to him and says, hey, there's a war on. Well, who am I going to enlist? Everybody has to do their bit. So get out here and you're going to go and you're going to take on a German spy ring. And so that's just a part of what he was trying to do with him. He was always willing to go back to him. A lot of people just dump him and they never want to see it again, no matter how much people ask for it. But he wanted help. If he couldn't serve, darn it, he was going to have his greatest literary creation serve. And he survived and triumphed, of course, did Holmes. And he really had nothing to lose, let's face it. But as with the cream of Britain's lost generation, the Great War took a heavy toll on Conan Doyle personally. He not only witnessed the horrors on the River Somme, he went and looked, as we said, he enlisted, but he didn't actually get to serve. By this time, he's 55. But he lost a son, his brother, two nephews, and two brothers-in-law.
Come on, man. It's insane.
It's just a huge personal toll for the guy.
It is. And this pain and loss led Conan Doyle to move deeper into a world that could not have been farther away from the science and logic of the classroom that had given birth to Holmes. After the horrors of war, the great author dove into the world of spiritualism and the occult, you know, trying to communicate with the dead and discover fairies and things like that.
It was only in the time of the war, when all these splendid young fellows were disappearing from our view, and the whole world was saying, well, what's become of them? Where are they? What are they doing now? Have they dissipated into nothing? Or are they still the grand fellows that we used to know? It was only at that time that I realized the overpowering importance to the human race of knowing more about this matter. Then it was that I flung myself more earnestly into it, and that I felt the highest purpose that I could possibly devote the remainder of my life to was trying to bring across to other people something of that knowledge and assurance which I had acquired myself.
Listen, you lose a son, you lose a brother, you lose two nephews. Yeah, you would try anything, I would imagine, to try to communicate with those people who were taken so horribly from you. It's nuts.
It's interesting to note, though, that he never tried to contact his first wife. At least there's no record of it, which, again, I think that back in that era, this is a man raised in the Victorian age, I think they had a very regimented way that they would go about thinking things. And like any of us, we're all walking dichotomies and we're all walking contradictions, I'm sure. And some of us are walking hypocrites, I guess, depending on how far we carry these things. But even Theodore Roosevelt said the idea of getting married again, he was utterly against second marriages, and he berated himself in his letters to his sister because he said that if I get married again down here, it's like when I'm assemblyman up in Albany keeping another wife down in New York City. And so he really was against it, but he was young, so young when his wife died that, you know, hopefully eventually he found his way to forgive himself, although he said if he knew that there was a heaven, his one supreme desire would be that he never had to go there and face both of his wives together. So,
yeah, exactly.
Here's a clip from that earlier interview where Sir Arthur transitions to discussing his interests in this other world beyond.
On the question of my taking up this psychic matter, curiously enough, my first experiences in that direction were just about the time when Sherlock Holmes was being built up in my mind. That would be about the year 1886 and 1887. So nobody can say that I formed my opinions on psychic matters very hastily. It's just 41 years now since I wrote a signed article upon the subject, which appeared in a magazine called Light, so that I put myself on record. During these 41 years, I never lost any opportunity of reading, of studying, and of experimenting on this matter. People ask me, will I write any more Sherlock Holmes stories? I certainly don't think it's at all probable. But as I grow older, the psychic subject always grows in intensity, and then one becomes more earnest upon it. And I should think that my few remaining years will probably be devoted much more in that direction than in the direction of literature.
He's defiant and impish as ever, looking at the world after this one as the ultimate adventure.
When people come along and contradict me, who have had no experience at all, read little, and perhaps never been to a seance, you can imagine that I don't take their opposition very seriously. When I talk on this subject, I'm not talking about what I believe. I'm not talking about what I think. I'm talking about what I know. There's an enormous difference, believe me, between believing a thing and knowing a thing. I'm talking about things that I've handled, that I've seen, that I've heard with my own ears. And always, mind you, in the presence of witnesses. I never risk hallucination. I usually, in most of my experiments, have had 6, 8, or 10 witnesses, all of whom have seen and heard the same things that I have done.
He let the press mock and the clergy condemn, but he kept at it with his wife Jean, ultimately spending the staggering sum, even without adjusting it for a century's inflation, of £250,000 in this hobby.
Man, that is a lot of money. During this period, Arthur Conan Doyle's fiction writing dwindled, and he wrote more with his character of Professor Challenger, who was the opposite of Holmes, in another attempt to break free from his shadow. But he did return to Holmes, as always, to write a dozen stories in The Casebook of Sherlock Holmes.
By 1929, suffering from angina, Conan Doyle nevertheless went on another adventure, a so-called psychic tour of Holland, Denmark, and Scandinavia. I bet there would have been a lot. Wait, hey, it's a ghost knocking, but it was just wooden shoes. Never mind.
That's right. Did you see that plate of pennekoken fly across the room?
I'm in Oslo. I see the fjords. Is this a haunted fjord? No, just a regular fjord. Oh, come on.
Yeah, just a fjord.
Conan Doyle, as he has this angina, as he's having this heart problem, The strain of that travel to the psychic realm, or in seek of the psychic realm, his little personal in search of, the strain proved too much, and he was bedridden upon his return home. They actually had to carry him off the boat. And except for one more time, he never managed to leave his house again. And that time was he crawled out of the house into the garden on a spring day, and they found him lying there, one hand clutching his heart and the other holding a single white snowdrop flower.
And the boy loved his mom. The storyteller, the would-be soldier and statesman, died on Monday, July 7th, 1930. His last words weren't written, and not for Holmes, but to his wife Jean. He said simply, "You are wonderful," and slipped into the world of the past on that he'd tried so hard to contact.
We want to thank Arthur Conan Doyle and, of course, Sherlock Holmes for helping us have a little bit of insight today and get out the story of an author that is known through one character, but really was a character in his own right and just a great human being and somebody we hope to learn more about as the years go by, because he has a huge volume of work that has nothing to do with Sherlock Holmes. And really, Sherlock Holmes would have been enough of a legacy for anybody to leave.
Absolutely. And do dive into the books or the movies or the old radio shows. It's a fun character. It's a fun take on England at the time. And the mysteries are terrific. And hey, thanks as always for joining us. I'm Owen Mugen.
I'm Dean Karyanis.
And we will see you next time. Elementary, of course, on the Angry History Show.
Visit angryhistory.com to learn more about the topics discussed on today's episode. Subscribe to the show on iTunes or stream it through one of iHeartRadio's many mobile platforms, including their smartphone apps, Roku, or car stereo station. You can also like us on Facebook, tweet us at Angry History, or send an email to angry@angryhistory.com. We'd love to hear your feedback.
Goodbye.